Chapter 2. Religion Kills. His aversion to religion, in the sense usually attached to the term, was of the same kind with that of Lucretius. He regarded it with the feelings due not to a mere mental delusion, but to a great moral evil. He looked upon it as the greatest enemy of morality, first by setting up factitious excellencies, belief in creeds, devotional feelings and ceremonies, not connected with the good of humankind, and causing these to be accepted as substitutes for genuine virtue, but above all, by radically vitiating the standard of morals, making it consist in doing the will of a being, on whom it lavishes indeed all the phrases of adulation, but whom in sober truth it depicts as eminently hateful. John Stuart Mill, on his father, in the Autobiography. Tantum religio poduit suadere malorum. To such heights of evil are men driven by religion. Lucretius, De Rerum Natura. Imagine that you can perform a feat of which I am incapable. Imagine, in other words, that you can picture an infinitely benign and all-powerful creator, who conceived of you, then made and shaped you, brought you into the world he had made for you, and now supervises and cares for you even while you sleep. Imagine further that if you obey the rules and commandments that he has lovingly prescribed, you will qualify for an eternity of bliss and repose. I do not say that I envy you this belief, because to me it seems like the wish for a horrible form of benevolent and unalterable dictatorship, but I do have a sincere question. Why does such a belief not make its adherents happy? It must seem to them that they have come into possession of a marvellous secret, of the sort that they could cling to in moments of even the most extreme adversity. Superficially, it does sometimes seem as if this is the case. I have been to evangelical services in black and in white communities, where the whole event was one long whoop of exultation at being saved, loved, and so forth. Many services, in all denominations and among almost all pagans, are exactly designed to evoke celebration and communal fiesta, which is precisely why I suspect them. There are more restrained and sober and elegant moments also. When I was a member of the Greek Orthodox Church, I could feel, even if I could not believe, the joyous words that are exchanged between believers on Easter morning. Christos Anesti, Christ is risen. Aletheos Anesti, he is risen indeed. I was a member of the Greek Orthodox Church, I might add, for a reason that explains why very many people profess an outward allegiance. I joined it to please my Greek parents-in-law. The archbishop who received me into his communion on the same day that he officiated at my wedding, thereby trousering two fees instead of the usual one, later became an enthusiastic cheerleader and fundraiser for his fellow Orthodox Serbian mass murderers, Radovan Karadzic and Ratko Mladic, who filled countless mass graves all over Bosnia. The next time I got married, which was by a Reform Jewish rabbi with an Einsteinian and Shakespearean bent, I had something a little more in common with the officiating person. But even he was aware that his lifelong homosexuality was, in principle, condemned as a capital offence, punishable by the founders of his religion, by stoning. As to the Anglican Church into which I was originally baptised, it may look like a pathetic bleating sheep today, but as the descendant of a church that's always enjoyed a state subsidy and an intimate relationship with hereditary monarchy, it has a historic responsibility for the Crusades, for persecution of Catholics, Jews and dissenters, and for combat against science and reason. The level of intensity fluctuates according to time and place, but it can be stated as a truth that religion is not, and in the long run cannot be, content with its own marvellous claims and sublime assurances. It must seek to interfere with the lives of non-believers, or heretics, or adherents of other faiths. It may speak about the bliss of the next world, but it wants power in this one. This is only to be expected. It is, after all, wholly man-made, and it does not have the confidence in its own various preachings, even to allow coexistence between different faiths. Take a single example from one of the most revered figures that modern religion has produced. In 1996, the Irish Republic held a referendum on one question, whether its state constitution should still prohibit divorce. Most of the political parties in an increasingly secular country urged voters to approve of a change in the law. They did so for two excellent reasons. It was no longer thought right that the Roman Catholic Church should legislate its morality for all citizens, and it was obviously impossible even to hope for eventual Irish reunification if the large Protestant minority in the north was continually repelled by the possibility of clerical rule. Mother Teresa flew all the way from Calcutta to help campaign, along with the church and its hardliners, for a no vote. In other words, an Irish woman married to a wife-beating and incestuous drunk should never expect anything better, and might endanger her soul if she begged for a fresh start, while, as for the Protestants, they could either choose the blessings of Rome or stay out altogether. There was not even the suggestion that Catholics could follow their own church's commandments while not imposing them on all other citizens. And this in the British Isles in the last decade of the 20th century. The referendum eventually amended the constitution, though by the narrowest of majorities. Mother Teresa in the same year gave an interview saying that she hoped her friend, Princess Diana, would be happier after she had escaped from what was an obviously miserable marriage. But it's less of a surprise to find the church applying sterner laws to the poor or offering indulgences to the rich. A week before the events of September the 11th, 2001, I was on a panel with Dennis Prager, who is one of America's better-known religious broadcasters. He challenged me in public to answer what he called a straight yes-no question, and I happily agreed. "Very well," he said. I was to imagine myself in a strange city as the evening was coming on. Toward me I was to imagine that I saw a large group of men approaching. Now, would I feel safer or less safe if I was to learn that they were just coming from a prayer meeting? As the reader will see, this is not a question to which a yes-no answer can be given, but I was able to answer it as if it were not hypothetical. Just to stay within the letter B, I have actually had that experience in Belfast, Beirut, Bombay, Belgrade, Bethlehem, and Baghdad. In each case I can say absolutely, and can give my reasons, why I would feel immediately threatened if I thought that the group of men approaching me in the dusk were coming from a religious observance. Here, then, is a very brief summary of the religiously inspired cruelty I witnessed in these six places. In Belfast, I have seen whole streets burned out by sectarian warfare between different sects of Christianity, and interviewed people whose relatives and friends have been kidnapped and killed or tortured by rival religious death squads, often for no other reason than membership of another confession. There is an old Belfast joke about the man stopped at a roadblock and asked his religion. When he replies that he is an atheist, he is asked, "Protestant or Catholic atheist?" I think this shows how the obsession has rotted even the legendary local sense of humour. In any case, this actually did happen to a friend of mine, and the experience was decidedly not an amusing one. The ostensible pretext for this mayhem is rival nationalisms, but the street language used by opposing rival tribes consists of terms insulting to the other confessions, prods and tags. For many years, the Protestant establishment wanted Catholics to be both segregated and suppressed. Indeed, in the days when the Ulster State was founded, its slogan was, "A Protestant Parliament for a Protestant People." Sectarianism is conveniently self-generating and can always be counted upon to evoke a reciprocal sectarianism. On the main point, the Catholic leadership was in agreement. It desired clerical-dominated schools and segregated neighbourhoods, the better to exert its control. So, in the name of God, the old hatreds were drilled into new generations of schoolchildren and are still being drilled. Even the word drill makes me queasy. A power tool of that kind was often used to destroy the kneecaps of those who fell foul of the religious gangs. When I first saw Beirut in the summer of 1975, it was still recognisable as the Paris of the Orient. Yet this apparent Eden was infested with a wide selection of serpents. It suffered from a positive surplus of religions, all of them accommodated by a sectarian state constitution. The president by law had to be a Christian, usually a Maronite Catholic, the Speaker of the Parliament a Muslim, and so on. This never worked well because it institutionalized differences of belief as well as of caste and ethnicity. The Shia Muslims were at the bottom of the social scale. The Kurds were disenfranchised altogether. The main Christian party was actually a Catholic militia called the Falange, or Phalanx, and had been founded by a Maronite Lebanese named Pierre Gemayel, who had been very impressed by his visit to Hitler's Berlin Olympics in 1936. It was later to achieve international notoriety by conducting the massacre of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in 1982, while acting under the orders of General Sharon. That a Jewish general should collaborate with a fascist party might seem grotesque enough, but they had a common Muslim enemy, and that was enough. Israel's eruption into Lebanon that year also gave an impetus to the birth of Hezbollah, the modestly named Party of God, which mobilized the Shia underclass and gradually placed it under the leadership of the theocratic dictatorship in Iran that had come to power 3 years previously. It was in lovely Lebanon, too, having learned to share the kidnapping business with the ranks of organized crime, that the faithful moved on to introduce us to the beauties of suicide bombing. I can still see that severed head in the road outside the near-shattered French embassy. On the whole, I tended to cross the street when the prayer meetings broke up. Bombay also used to be considered a pearl of the Orient, with its necklace of lights along the Corniche and its magnificent British Raj architecture. It was one of India's most diverse and plural cities, and its many layers of texture have been cleverly explored by Salman Rushdie, especially in The Moor's Last Sigh and in the films of Meer Nair. It is true that there had been intercommunal fighting there during the time in 1947-48 when the grand historic movement for Indian self-government was being ruined by Muslim demands for a separate state and by the fact that the Congress Party was led by a pious Hindu. But probably as many people took refuge in Bombay during that moment of religious bloodlust as were driven or fled from it. A form of cultural coexistence resumed, as often happens when cities are exposed to the sea and to influences from outside. Parsis, former Zoroastrians who had been persecuted in Persia, were a prominent minority, and the city was also host to a historically significant community of Jews. But this was not enough to content Mr. Bal Thackeray and his Shiv Sena Hindu nationalist movement, who in the 1990s decided that Bombay should be run by and for his co-religionists, and who loosed a tide of goons and thugs onto the streets. Just to show he could do it, he ordered the city renamed as Mumbai, which is partly why I included it in this list under its traditional title. Belgrade had, until the 1980s, been the capital of Yugoslavia, or the land of the southern Slavs, which meant by definition that it was the capital of a multi-ethnic and multi-confessional state. But a secular Croatian intellectual once gave me a warning that, as in Belfast, took the form of a sour joke. "If I tell people that I'm an atheist and a Croat," he said, "people ask me how I can prove I'm not a Serb." To be Croatian, in other words, is to be Roman Catholic. To be a Serb is to be Christian Orthodox. In the 1940s, this meant a Nazi puppet state, set up in Croatia and enjoying the patronage of the Vatican, which naturally sought to exterminate all the Jews in the region, but also undertook a campaign of forcible conversion directed at the other Christian community. Tens of thousands of Orthodox Christians were either slaughtered or deported in consequence, and a vast concentration camp was set up near the town of Jasenovac. So disgusting was the regime of General Ante Pavelić and his Ustasha party that even many German officers protested at having to be associated with it. By the time I visited the site of the Jasenovac camp in 1992, the jackboot was somewhat on the other foot. The Croatian cities of Vukovar and Dubrovnik had been brutally shelled by the armed forces of Serbia, now under the control of Slobodan Milosevic. The mainly Muslim city of Sarajevo had been encircled and was being bombarded around the clock. Elsewhere in Bosnia-Herzegovina, especially along the river Drina, whole towns were pillaged and massacred in what the Serbs themselves termed ethnic cleansing. In point of fact, religious cleansing would have been nearer the mark. Milosevic was an ex-communist bureaucrat who'd mutated into a xenophobic nationalist, and his anti-Muslim crusade, which was a cover for the annexation of Bosnia to a greater Serbia, was to a large extent carried out by unofficial militias operating under his deniable control. These gangs were made up of religious bigots, often blessed by Orthodox priests and bishops, and sometimes augmented by fellow Orthodox volunteers from Greece and Russia. They made a special attempt to destroy all evidence of Ottoman civilization, as in the specially atrocious case of the dynamiting of several historic minarets in Banja Luka, which was done during a ceasefire and not as the result of any battle. The same was true, as is often forgotten, of their Catholic counterparts. The Ustasha formations were revived in Croatia and made a vicious attempt to take over Herzegovina, as they had during the Second World War. The beautiful city of Mostar was also shelled and besieged, and the world-famous Stari Most, or Old Bridge, dating from Turkish times and listed by UNESCO as a cultural site of world importance, was bombarded until it fell into the river below. In effect, the extremist Catholic and Orthodox forces were colluding in a bloody partition and cleansing of Bosnia-Herzegovina. They were, and still are, largely spared the public shame of this because the world's media preferred the simplification of Croat and Serb and only mentioned religion when discussing the Muslims. But the triad of terms, Croat, Serb and Muslim, is unequal and misleading in that it equates two nationalities in one religion. The same blunder is made in a different way in coverage of Iraq, with the Sunni, Shia, Kurd trilateral. There were at least 10,000 Serbs in Sarajevo throughout the siege, and one of the leading commanders of its defence, an officer and gentleman named General Jovan Divjak, whose hand I was proud to shake under fire, was a Serb also. The city's Jewish population, which dated from 1492, also identified itself, for the most part, with the government and the cause of Bosnia. It would have been far more accurate if the press and television had reported that today the Orthodox Christian forces resumed their bombardment of Sarajevo, or yesterday the Catholic militia succeeded in collapsing the Stari Most. But confessional terminology was reserved only for Muslims, even as their murderers went to all the trouble of distinguishing themselves by wearing large Orthodox crosses over their bandoliers, or by taping portraits of the Virgin Mary to their rifle butts. Thus, once again, religion poisons everything, including our own faculties of discernment. As for Bethlehem, I suppose I would be willing to concede to Mr. Prager that on a good day I would feel safe enough, standing around outside the Church of the Nativity as evening came on. It is in Bethlehem, not far from Jerusalem, that many believe that with the cooperation of an immaculately conceived virgin, God was delivered of a son. Now the birth of Jesus Christ was in this wise. When his mother Mary was espoused to Joseph, before they came together she was found with child of the Holy Ghost. Yes, and the Greek demigod Perseus was born when the god Jupiter visited the virgin Danae as a shower of gold and got her with child. The god Buddha was born through an opening in his mother's flank. Catlicus the serpent skirted caught a little ball of feathers from the sky and hid it in her bosom, and the Aztec god Huitzilopochtli was thus conceived. The virgin Nana took a pomegranate from the tree watered by the blood of the slain Agdestris and laid it in her bosom, and gave birth to the god Attis. The virgin daughter of a Mongol king awoke one night and found herself bathed in a great light, which caused her to give birth to Genghis Khan. Krishna was born of the virgin Devaka. Horus was born of the virgin Isis. Mercury was born of the virgin Maya. Romulus was born of the virgin Rhea Silvia. For some reason, many religions force themselves to think of the birth canal as a one-way street, and even the Quran treats the Virgin Mary with reverence. However, this made no difference during the Crusades when a papal army set out to recapture Bethlehem and Jerusalem from the Muslims, incidentally destroying many Jewish communities and sacking heretical Christian Byzantium along the way, and inflicted a great massacre in the narrow streets of Jerusalem where, according to the historical and gleeful chroniclers, the spilled blood reached up to the bridles of the horses. Some of these tempests of hatred and bigotry and bloodlust have passed away, though new ones are always impending in this area. But meanwhile, a person can feel relatively unmolested in and around Manger Square, which is the centre, as its name suggests, of a tourist trap of such unrelieved tawdriness as to put Lourdes itself to shame. When I first visited this pitiful town, it was under the nominal control of a largely Christian Palestinian municipality, linked to one particular political dynasty identified with the Frege family. When I have seen it since, it has generally been under a brutal curfew imposed by the Israeli military authorities, whose presence on the West Bank is itself not unconnected with belief in certain ancient scriptural prophecies, though this time with a different promise made by a different god to a different people. Now comes the turn of still another religion. The forces of Hamas, who claim the whole of Palestine as an Islamic waqf, or holy dispensation, sacred to Islam, have begun to elbow aside the Christians of Bethlehem. Their leader, Mahmoud al-Azhar, has announced that all inhabitants of the Islamic State of Palestine will be expected to conform to Muslim law. In Bethlehem, it is now proposed that non-Muslims be subjected to the Al Jazir tax, the historic levy imposed on dhimmis, or unbelievers, under the old Ottoman Empire. Female employees of the municipality are forbidden to greet male visitors with a handshake. In Gaza, a young woman named Yusra al-Azami was shot dead in April 2005, for the crime of sitting unchaperoned in a car with her fiancé. The young man escaped with only a vicious beating. The leaders of the Hamas Vice and Virtue Squad justified this casual murder and torture by saying that there had been suspicion of immoral behaviour. In once secular Palestine, Mobs of sexually repressed young men are conscripted to snoop around parked cars and given permission to do what they like. I once heard the late Abba Iban, one of Israel's more polished and thoughtful diplomats and statesmen, give a talk in New York. The first thing to strike the eye about the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, he said, was the ease of its solubility. From this arresting start, he went on to say, with the authority of a former foreign minister and UN representative, that the essential point was a simple one. Two peoples of roughly equivalent size had a claim to the same land. The solution was, obviously, to create two states side by side. Surely something so self-evident was within the wit of man to encompass. And so it would have been, decades ago, if the messianic rabbis and mullahs and priests could have been kept out of it. But the exclusive claims to God-given authority, made by hysterical clerics on both sides, and further stoked by Armageddon-minded Christians, who hope to bring on the apocalypse, preceded by the death or conversion of all Jews, have made the situation insufferable, and put the whole of humanity in the position of hostage to a quarrel that now features the threat of nuclear war. Religion poisons everything. As well as a menace to civilization, it has become a threat to human survival. To come last to Baghdad. This is one of the greatest centres of learning and culture in history. It was here that some of the lost works of Aristotle and other Greeks, lost because the Christian authorities had burned some, suppressed others, and closed the schools of philosophy, on the grounds that there could have been no useful reflections on morality before the preaching of Jesus, were preserved, retranslated, and transmitted via Andalusia back to the ignorant Christian West. Baghdad's libraries and poets and architects were renowned. Many of these attainments took place under Muslim caliphs, who sometimes permitted and as often repressed their expression. But Baghdad also bears the traces of ancient Chaldean and Nestorian Christianity and was one of the many centres of the Jewish diaspora. Until the late 1940s, it was home to as many Jews as were living in Jerusalem. I am not here going to elaborate a position on the overthrow of Saddam Hussein in April 2003. I shall simply say that those who regarded his regime as a secular one are deluding themselves. It is true that the Ba'ath Party was founded by a man named Michel Aflaq, a sinister Christian with a sympathy for fascism, and it is also true that membership of that party was open to all religions, though its Jewish membership was, I have every reason to think, limited. However, at least since his calamitous invasion of Iran in 1979, which led to furious accusations from the Iranian theocracy that he was an infidel, Saddam Hussein had decked out his whole rule, which was based in any case on a tribal minority of the Sunni minority, as one of piety and jihad. The Syrian Ba'ath Party, also based on a confessional fragment of society aligned with the Alawite minority, has likewise enjoyed a long and hypocritical relationship with the Iranian mullahs. Saddam had inscribed the words Allahu Akbar, God is great, on the Iraqi flag. He had sponsored a huge international conference of holy warriors and mullahs, and maintained very warm relations with their other chief state sponsor in the region, namely the genocidal government of Sudan. He had built the largest mosque in the region and named it the Mother of All Battles Mosque, complete with a Quran written in blood that he claimed to be his own. When launching his own genocidal campaign against the mainly Sunni people of Kurdistan, a campaign that involved the thoroughgoing use of chemical atrocity weapons and the murder and deportation of hundreds of thousands of people, he had called it Operation Anfal, borrowing by this term a Quranic justification, the spoils of Surah No. 8, for the despoilment and destruction of non-believers. When the coalition forces crossed the Iraqi border, they found Saddam's army dissolving like a sugar lump in hot tea, but met with some quite tenacious resistance from a paramilitary group stiffened with foreign jihadists called the Fedayeen Saddam. One of the jobs of this group was to execute anybody who publicly welcomed the Western intervention, and some revolting public hangings and mutilations were soon captured on video for all to see. At a minimum, it can be agreed by all that the Iraqi people had endured much in the preceding 35 years of war and dictatorship, that the Saddam regime could not have gone on forever as an outlaw system within international law, and therefore that, whatever objections there might be to the actual means of regime change, the whole society deserved a breathing space in which to consider reconstruction and reconciliation. Not one single minute of breathing space was allowed. Everybody knows the sequel. The supporters of Al-Qaeda, led by a Jordanian jailbird named Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, launched a frenzied campaign of murder and sabotage. They not only slew unveiled women and secular journalists and teachers, they not only set off bombs in Christian churches, Iraq's population is perhaps 2% Christian, and shot or maimed Christians who made and sold alcohol. They not only made a video of the mass shooting and throat-cutting of a contingent of Nepalese guest workers, who were assumed to be Hindu, and thus beyond all consideration. These atrocities might be counted as more or less routine. They directed the most toxic part of their campaign of terror at fellow Muslims. The mosques and funeral processions of the long-oppressed Shiite majority were blown up. Pilgrims coming long distances to the newly accessible shrines at Karbala and Najaf did so at the risk of their lives. In a letter to his leader Osama bin Laden, Zarqawi gave the two main reasons for this extraordinarily evil policy. In the first place, as he wrote, the Shiites were heretics who did not take the correct Salafist path of purity. They were thus a fit prey for the truly holy. In the second place, if a religious war could be induced within Iraqi society, the plans of the Crusader West could be set at naught. The obvious hope was to ignite a counter-response from the Shia themselves, which would drive Sunni Arabs into the arms of their bin Ladenist protectors. And, despite some noble appeals for restraint from the Shiite Grand Ayatollah Sistani, it did not prove very difficult to elicit such a response. Before long, Shia death squads, often garbed in police uniforms, were killing and torturing random members of the Sunni Arab faith. The surreptitious influence of the neighbouring Islamic Republic of Iran was not difficult to detect, and in some Shia areas also, it became dangerous to be an unveiled woman or a secular person. Iraq boasts quite a long history of intermarriage and intercommunal cooperation. But a few years of this hateful dialectic soon succeeded in creating an atmosphere of misery, distrust, hostility and sect-based politics. Once again, religion had poisoned everything. In all the cases I have mentioned, there were those who protested in the name of religion and who tried to stand athwart the rising tide of fanaticism and the cult of death. I can think of a handful of priests and bishops and rabbis and imams who have put humanity ahead of their own sect or creed. History gives us many other such examples, which I'm going to discuss later on. But this is a compliment to humanism, not to religion. If it comes to that, these crises have also caused me and many other atheists to protest on behalf of Catholics suffering discrimination in Ireland, of Bosnian Muslims facing extermination in the Christian Balkans, of Shia Afghans and Iraqis being put to the sword by Sunni jihadists, and vice versa, and numberless other such cases. To adopt such a stand is the elementary duty of a self-respecting human, but the general reluctance of clerical authorities to issue unambiguous condemnation, whether it is the Vatican in the case of Croatia, or the Saudi or Iranian leaderships in the case of their respective confessions, is uniformly disgusting, and so is the willingness of each flock to revert to atavistic behaviour under the least provocation. No, Mr. Prager, I have not found it a prudent rule to seek help as the prayer meeting breaks up, and this, as I told you, is only the letter B. In all these cases, anyone concerned with human safety or dignity would have to hope fervently for a mass outbreak of democratic and republican secularism. I did not have to travel to all these exotic places in order to see the poison doing its work. Long before the critical day of September 11, 2001, I could sense that religion was beginning to reassert its challenge to civil society. When I am not operating as a tentative and amateur foreign correspondent, I lead a rather tranquil and orderly life, writing books and essays, teaching my students to love English literature, attending agreeable conferences of literary types, taking part in the transient arguments that arise in publishing and the academy. But even this rather sheltered existence has been subject to outrageous invasions and insults and challenges. On February the 14th, 1989, my friend Salman Rushdie was hit by a simultaneous death sentence and life sentence for the crime of writing a work of fiction. To be more precise, the theocratic head of a foreign state, the Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran, publicly offered money, in his own name, to suborn the murder of a novelist who was a citizen of another country. Those who were encouraged to carry out this bribed assassination scheme, which extended to all those involved in the publication of the Satanic Verses, were offered not just the cold cash, but also a free ticket to paradise. It's impossible to imagine a greater affront to every value of free expression. The Ayatollah had not read, and probably could not read, and in any case forbade everyone else to read, the novel. But he succeeded in igniting ugly demonstrations among Muslims in Britain as well as across the world, where crowds burned the book and screamed for the author to be fed to the flames as well. This episode, partly horrifying and partly grotesque, of course had its origins in the material or real world. The Ayatollah, having flung away hundreds of thousands of young Iranian lives in an attempt to prolong the war which Saddam Hussein had started, and thereby to turn it into a victory for his own reactionary theology, had recently been forced to acknowledge reality and to agree to the United Nations ceasefire resolution that he had sworn he would drink poison before signing. He was in need, in other words, of an issue. A group of reactionary Muslims in South Africa, who sat in the puppet parliament of the apartheid regime, had announced that if Mr. Rushdie attended a book fair in their country, he would be killed. A fundamentalist group in Pakistan had shed blood on the streets. Khomeini had to prove that he could not be outdone by anybody. As it happens, there are some statements allegedly made by the Prophet Muhammad which are difficult to reconcile with Muslim teaching. Quranic scholars had attempted to square this circle by suggesting that in these instances the Prophet was accidentally taking dictation from Satan instead of from God. This ruse, which would not have disgraced the most sinuous school of medieval Christian apologetics, provided an excellent opportunity for a novelist to explore the relationship between Holy Writ and literature. But the literal mind does not understand the ironic mind, and sees it always as a source of danger. Moreover, Rushdie had been brought up as a Muslim and had an understanding of the Quran, which meant in effect that he was an apostate. And apostasy, according to the Quran, is punishable by death. There is no right to change religion, and all religious states have always insisted on harsh penalties for those who try it. A number of serious attempts were made to kill Rushdie by religious death squads supported from Iranian embassies. His Italian and Japanese translators were criminally assaulted, apparently in one case in the absurd belief that the translator might know his whereabouts, and one of them was savagely mutilated as he lay dying. His Norwegian publisher was shot in the back several times with a high-velocity rifle and left for dead in the snow, but astonishingly survived. One might have thought that such arrogant state-sponsored homicide, directed at a lonely and peaceful individual who pursued a life devoted to language, would have called forth a general condemnation. But such was not the case. In considered statements, the Vatican, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the chief Sephardic rabbi of Israel all took a stand in sympathy with the Ayatollah. So did the Cardinal Archbishop of New York and many other lesser religious figures. While they usually managed a few words in which to deplore the resort to violence, all these men stated that the main problem raised by the publication of the Satanic Verses was not murder by mercenaries, but blasphemy. Some public figures not in holy orders, such as the Marxist writer John Berger, the Tory historian Hugh Trevor Roper, and the doyen of espionage authors John le Carré, also pronounced that Rushdie was the author of his own troubles, and had brought them on himself by offending a great monotheistic religion. There seemed nothing fantastic to these people in the British police having to defend an Indian-born ex-Muslim citizen from a concerted campaign to take his life in the name of God. Sheltered, as my own life normally is, I had a taste of this surreal situation when Mr. Rushdie came to Washington over the Thanksgiving weekend of 1993 in order to keep an appointment with President Clinton, and stayed for a night or two in my apartment. An enormous and forbidding security operation was necessary to bring this about, and when the visit was over, I was asked to pay a visit to the Department of State. There I was informed by a senior official that believable chatter had been intercepted, expressing the intention of revenge on me and on my family. I was advised to change my address and my telephone number, which seemed an unlikely way of avoiding reprisal. However, it did put me on notice of what I already knew. It is not possible for me to say, well, you pursue your Shiite dream of a hidden imam, and I pursue my study of Thomas Paine and George Orwell, and the world is big enough for both of us. The true believer cannot rest until the whole world bows the knee. Is it not obvious to all, say the pious, that religious authority is paramount, and that those who decline to recognize it have forfeited their right to exist? It was, as it happens, the murderers of the Shia who forced this point upon the world's attention a few years later. So ghastly had been the regime of the Taliban in Afghanistan, which slaughtered the Shiite Hazara population, that Iran itself had considered invading the country in 1999. And so great was the Taliban's addiction to profanity that it had methodically shelled and destroyed one of the world's greatest cultural artifacts, the twin Buddha statues at Bamiyan, which in their magnificence showed the fusion of Hellenic and other styles in the Afghan past. But, pre-Islamic as they undoubtedly were, the statues were a standing insult to the Taliban and their al-Qaeda guests. And the reduction of Bamiyan to shards and rubble foreshadowed the incineration of two other twin structures, as well as almost 3,000 human beings, in downtown Manhattan in the fall of 2001. Everybody has their own 9/11 story. I shall skip over mine, except to say that someone I slightly knew was flown into the wall of the Pentagon, having managed to call her husband and give a description of her murderers and their tactics, and having learned from him that it was not a hijack and that she was going to die. From the roof of my building in Washington, I could see the smoke rising from the other side of the river, and I've never since passed the Capitol or the White House without thinking of what might have happened were it not for the courage and resourcefulness of the passengers on the fourth plane, who managed to bring it down in a Pennsylvanian field, only 20 minutes flying time from its destination. Well, I was able to write in a further reply to Dennis Prager, now you have your answer. The 19 suicide murderers of New York and Washington and Pennsylvania were beyond any doubt the most sincere believers on those planes. Perhaps we can hear a little less about how people of faith possess moral advantages that others can only envy. And what is to be learned from the jubilation and the ecstatic propaganda with which this great feat of fidelity has been greeted in the Islamic world? At the time, the United States had an attorney general named John Ashcroft, who had stated that America had no king but Jesus, a claim that was exactly two words too long. It had a president who wanted to hand over the care of the poor to faith-based institutions. Might this not be a moment where the light of reason and the defense of a society that separated church and state and valued free expression and free inquiry be granted a point or two? The disappointment was, and to me remains, acute. Within hours, the Reverends Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell had announced that the immolation of their fellow creatures was a divine judgment on a secular society that tolerated homosexuality and abortion. At the solemn memorial service for the victims held in the beautiful National Cathedral in Washington, an address was permitted from Billy Graham, a man whose record of opportunism and anti-Semitism is in itself a minor national disgrace. His absurd sermon made the claim that all the dead were now in paradise and would not return to us even if they could. I say absurd because it's impossible, even in the most lenient terms, to believe that a good number of sinful citizens had not been murdered by al-Qaeda that day. And there is no reason to believe that Billy Graham knew the current whereabouts of their souls, let alone of their posthumous desires. But there was also something sinister in hearing detailed claims to knowledge of paradise, of the sort that Bin Laden himself was making on behalf of the assassins. Matters continued to deteriorate in the interval between the removal of the Taliban and the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. A senior military official named General William Boykin announced that he had been vouchsafed a vision while serving earlier during the fiasco in Somalia. Apparently, the face of Satan himself had been detected by some aerial photography of Mogadishu, but this had only increased the confidence of the general that his god was stronger than the evil deity of the opposition. At the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, it was revealed that Jewish and agnostic cadets were being viciously bullied by a group of unpunished, born-again cadres who insisted that only those accepting Jesus as a personal savior were qualified to serve. The deputy commander of the academy sent out emails proselytizing for a national day of Christian prayer. A chaplain named Melinda Morton, who complained about this hysteria and intimidation, was abruptly transferred to a faraway base in Japan. Meanwhile, empty-headed multiculturalism also contributed its portion by, among other means, ensuring the distribution of cheap and mass-produced Saudi editions of the Quran for use in America's prison system. These Wahhabi texts went even further than the original in recommending holy war against all Christians and Jews and secularists. To observe all this was to witness a kind of cultural suicide, an assisted suicide, at which believers and unbelievers were both prepared to officiate. It ought to have been pointed out at once that this sort of thing, as well as being unethical and unprofessional, was also flat-out unconstitutional and anti-American. James Madison, the author of the First Amendment to the Constitution, prohibiting any law respecting an establishment of religion, was also an author of Article 6, which states unambiguously that no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust. His later detached memoranda make it very plain that he opposed the government appointment of chaplains in the first place, either in the armed forces or at the opening ceremonies of Congress. The establishment of the chaplainship to Congress is a palpable violation of equal rights, as well as of constitutional principles. As to clerical presence in the armed forces, Madison wrote, "The object of this establishment is seducing. The motive to it is laudable. But is it not safer to adhere to a right principle and trust to its consequences than confide in the reasoning, however specious, in favour of a wrong one? Look through the armies and navies of the world and say whether in the appointment of their ministers of religion the spiritual interest of the flocks or the temporal interest of the shepherd be most in view." Anyone citing Madison today would very likely be thought either subversive or insane, and yet without him and Thomas Jefferson, co-authors of the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom, the United States would have gone on as it was, with Jews prohibited from holding office in some states, Catholics in others, and Protestants in Maryland, the latter a state where profane words concerning the Holy Trinity were punishable by torture, branding, and, at the third offence, death without benefit of clergy. Georgia might have persisted in maintaining that its official state faith was Protestantism, whichever one of Luther's many hybrids that might have turned out to be. As the debate over intervention in Iraq became more heated, positive torrents of nonsense poured from the pulpits. Most churches opposed the effort to remove Saddam Hussein, and the Pope disgraced himself utterly by issuing a personal invitation to the wanted war criminal Tariq Aziz, a man responsible for the state murder of children. Not only was Aziz welcomed at the Vatican as the senior Catholic member of a ruling fascist party, not the first time that such an indulgence had been granted. He was then taken to Assisi for a personal session of prayer at the shrine of St. Francis, who apparently used to lecture to birds. This, he must have thought, was altogether too easy. On the other side of the confessional span, some but not all American evangelicals thundered joyously about the prospect of winning the Muslim world for Jesus. I say some but not all because one fundamentalist splinter group has since taken to picketing the funerals of American soldiers killed in Iraq, claiming that their murders are God's punishment for American homosexuality. One especially tasteful sign, waved in the faces of the mourners, is, "Thank God for IEDs, the roadside bombs placed by equally anti-gay Muslim fascists." It is not my problem to decide which theology is the correct one here. I would say the chances of either being right are approximately the same. Charles Stanley, whose weekly sermons from the First Baptist Church in Atlanta are watched by millions, could have been any demagogic imam as he said, "We should offer to serve the war effort in any way possible. God battles with people who oppose him, who fight against him and his followers." His organization's Baptist Press News Service printed an article from a missionary, exulting that American foreign policy and military might have opened an opportunity for the gospel in the land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Never to be outdone, Tim LaHaye decided to go even further. Best known as the co-author of the best-selling Left Behind pulp novel series, which readies the average American for the rapture and then for Armageddon, he spoke of Iraq as a focal point of end-time events. Other biblical enthusiasts tried to link Saddam Hussein with the wicked King Nebuchadnezzar of ancient Babylon, a comparison that the dictator himself would probably have approved, given his rebuilding of the old walls at Babylon with bricks that had his name inscribed on every one of them. Thus, instead of a rational discussion about the best way to contain and defeat religious fanaticism, one had the mutual reinforcement of two forms of that mania. The jihadist assault re-conjured the blood-stained spectre of the Crusaders. In this respect, religion is not unlike racism. One version of it inspires and provokes the other. I was once asked another trick question, slightly more searching than Dennis Prager's, that was designed to uncover my level of latent prejudice. You are on a subway platform in New York, late at night, in a deserted station. Suddenly, a group of a dozen black men appears. Do you stay where you are, or move to the exit? I was able again to reply that I had had this exact experience. Waiting alone for a train well after midnight, I had been suddenly joined by a crew of repairmen exiting the tunnel with their tools and work gloves. All of them were black. I felt instantly safer and moved toward them. I have no idea what their religious affiliation was. But in every other case that I've cited, religion has been an enormous multiplier of tribal suspicion and hatred, with members of each group talking of the other in precisely the tones of the bigot. The Christians and Jews eat defiled pig meat and swill poisonous alcohol. Buddhist and Muslim Sri Lankans blamed the wine-oriented Christmas celebrations of 2004 for the immediately following tsunami. Catholics are dirty and have too many children. Muslims breed like rabbits and wipe their bottoms with the wrong hand. Jews have lice in their beards and seek the blood of Christian children to add flavour and zest to their Passover matzos. And so it goes on.